hello, and welcome back. We're back again. Celebration Day, going to be celebrating a new champion in the NFL. Going to be celebrating lives that have been lost. We're going to be also celebrating victories that have been won already. Yep, this is the Master Plan, and yes, I am JT, and once again, on a crisp Sunday morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm with you for the next hour, and we're going to be talking about all of what I just said, victories and celebrations, and a heck of a matchup that's going to take place. Everybody knows this is Super Bowl Sunday. Everybody's gearing up to celebrate for the pregame and celebrate during the game and celebrate after the game. This is, like I said, is a day of celebration. That's why I'm playing a tune that's going way back to 1971. It's 42 years old or 41 years old. The name of the group is Rare Earth, and it's called I Want to Celebrate. I'm going to step back for a little bit, listen to a little bit of Rare Earth, and I'll come back and we'll talk about everything I just talked about. The number to call in is 347-637-3220. I'll say it again, 347-637-3220. I'll be back in a short bit. Born in 1936 and passed away in 2012, unfortunately by his own hand. He was 75 years young, an innovator, definitely moving and shaker in the entertainment business, brought joy to all of all races of all kinds for the time that the show was on the air. I'm talking about the love, peace, and soul. I'm talking about Don Cornelius. Passed away this week, unfortunately, by his own hand. And like I said, he's 75 years old, 75 years young. Anybody who liked R&B or liked new artists, liked to see dancing, new styles, new dance moves, always tuned in on Saturday morning to watch Don Cornelius when he first started the program, and it moved on to other hosts, but Don Cornelius was the main host, was witness to history-making shows each and every week that that show was on, competed against the American Bandstand, which is Dick Clark's baby, took a lot of guts and foresight for Don Cornelius to bring the concept together and make it last as long as it did. God bless Don Cornelius. We celebrate his life and all that he's done up until the time, well, forever, let me put it that way. There's another person that was also a history-making and an innovator and also a very, I wouldn't say controversial figure, but he was a figure in the boxing industry. I'm talking about the one and only Angelo Dundee. He passed away, and we definitely celebrate his life. He was 90 years young, he lived a long and fruitful life. And for those who are not familiar with Angelo Dundee, I'm going to play a short clip from an ESPN Jeremy Schapp that chronicles his life. I'll be back after this short clip to talk about a little about Angelo Dundee, and then we're going to talk about some unboxing. Like I said, this is a day of celebration, so this different type of celebrations, and we're into boxing right now, so let's listen to this clip first.
In a career that spanned nearly seven decades, from just after World War II up to the present day, Angelo Dundee trained 15 world champions, including giants such as Ray Leonard, George Foreman, and Carmen Basilio. For his work with just those three fighters, Dundee would rank among boxing's greatest trainers. But nearly from the day they first met in a Louisville hotel in 1959, Dundee would be inextricably linked with another fighter, the fighter of his era, arguably of all time. Together, Angelo Dundee and Muhammad Ali would form the most fruitful partnership in the annals of the sweet science. With Dundee in his corner for nearly 60 fights in more than 20 years, Ali would win the title first from Sonny Liston, then a decade later from George Foreman, and then, again, from Leon Spinks. Of course, Dundee was no mere observer to Ali's feats. In fight after fight, his quick thinking was one of Ali's most valuable assets. On more than one occasion, Dundee was accused of gamesmanship bordering on cheating. Early in Ali's career, when he was fighting Henry Cooper, Dundee helped rescue his dazed fighter by exaggerating a glove malfunction and illegally administering smelling salts. There were those who claimed the rope-a-dope in Zaire was only made possible by Dundee, who they say loosened the ropes before the fight, a charge Dundee always denied. Whether or not he facilitated the demise of Henry Cooper or George Foreman, it was always clear that Dundee would do virtually anything for his fighter, for Ali. And even as Ali changed names and religions and wives, as he cut off Malcolm X and banished confidants like Bundini Brown, he couldn't let go of Dundee. Dundee once said, "Muhammad Ali was the nicest thing that ever happened to my life." A good case can be made that Angelo Dundee was the nicest thing that ever happened to Muhammad Ali.
And like I said, Angelo passed away a few days ago at the ripe old age of 90. And all I can say is God bless Don Cornelius and God bless Angelo Dundee for their contributions to the world and to their families. They were exceptional men in their respective endeavors, and they left their mark on the music industry, the entertainment industry, and in the boxing, a sport of boxing. So God bless those two. And I also want to talk about the, like I said, this is the day of celebration. Different types of celebrations and victories. Last night, there were two boxing matches. I don't know if anyone was able to watch them. But I'm talking about one of them was the, they were on the same fight card. I'm talking about Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. against Marco Antonio Rubio. And let me go with first with Junior. Well, anyone who watched the fight or didn't watch the fight, well, will know that if they read online or in the paper or whatever their news source would be to get sports, especially in the sport of boxing, that he retained the WBC middleweight title Saturday night, earning a unanimous decision over, like I said, Marco Antonio Rubio. The judges scored the bout 18-10, 16-12, 15-13 for Chavez. And it drew a mixed reaction to the people in San Antonio. That's where it was at. It was in the Alamo Dome. And neither fighter went down despite taking continuous heavy blows to the head and body throughout the 12 rounds. This was a pretty, I wouldn't say, close fight because it was a unanimous decision, but Chavez overcame a gutsy performance by Rubio despite having some trouble entering the fight. Chavez, about 2 weeks ago, he was arrested on drunk driving charges in L.A. Now, if you're training for a fight, what the heck are you doing drinking for one, and drinking way too much for another, getting drunk? So, quite naturally, you would think that he was struggling in this fight. I would think he would. I mean, you can't drink and train at the same time. It just doesn't mix. But being that as it may, Chavez, and I quote, this is a quote he said, he wasn't as tough as I thought he would be. I felt good about myself the whole fight. I felt a lot stronger than him. He never hurt me in the fight, which is a typical thing fighters say for the most part, that he never gets hurt. I felt his punches, but he never hurt me. That's just I don't know if it's a macho thing, testosterone type of thing, but it always seems that fighters, whenever they fight each other, he always got to say that he never hurt me, even after the fight. What's that got to do with if he hurt you after the fight? Well, you can admit it. It's no crime. You don't want to have your opponent see you like you hurt during the fight, but the guy hits you. And he gave you a good shot and he hurt you, why not admit it? But what can I say? You know, that's just the machismo of a fighter. The fighters spent most of the bout standing shoulder to shoulder, which resulted in a couple headbutts. And Rubio got two warnings for that. Two warnings for low blows. So they're headbutting each other. These two Mexicans are going at each other. So you know you're going to get a little bit cheap stuff going back and forth with these guys, because I'm not saying the Mexicans do that, but the ego of the Hispanic fighter has lent to little cheap things here and there, just on the borderline of being illegal. Okay, although Chavez won handily on all the scorecards, many of the closely contested rounds could have been scored either way. So, I mean, like I said, you could see that he was winning, but it wasn't a completely convincing win. That's why when they read the final results, that they got a couple of mixed reactions, because it wasn't as clear cut as the voting was. But Rubio, and I got to hand it to him, This is his quote. "He was too heavy for me. I couldn't handle his weight. It was body to body. It was way too much for me to handle." Now that's what you want to hear from a boxer when he gets, if he gets beat or even if he wins, that's a truthful statement, this guy. And you how many boxers say that? How many boxers? I got to hand it to Rubio for saying that. Chavez landed 237 of 560 punches, so he was throwing a lot of punches. But Rubio landed 201 of 962, so he was throwing a lot more punches, even though he didn't land as much. They exchanged a series of vicious blows in the 11th round, with Rubio appearing to daze Chavez with a couple of overhand rights through the round. Now, earlier I said Chavez said he never hurt me. Well, it's obvious if you watch the fight, especially late in the fight, that Chavez was dazed a few times. But just like I said, that machismo says he never hurt me. But you could clearly see that he was shaky at times. And like I said, the number to call in is 347-637-3220. We also have a chat room. Chat room's open. If you have a statement, comment, or a question, it's always open season in the chat room. I always say that. I don't care if it's anything. I don't care what you want to say. It doesn't even have to relate to the subject matter that I'm talking about right now. If you have something to say, whether talking to me on the phone or through the chat room, I'll listen to it. I'll respond to it. We can have a dialogue to it if you want. I have no problem with that. When I get on the master plan, I may have an agenda that I want to follow, but I'm not locked into that. You can bring me to another place if you want. Enlighten me if you like. Educate me if you like. I'm open to it all. Anyway, let's get back to this. Now, like I said, Chavez was dazed by Rubio in late in the fight in the 11th round. But Chavez came back with a couple of overhand rights midway through the round and kept pressing forward. And eventually, like I said in the beginning of this, he won a unanimous decision. Now, also, another good fight that was yesterday was Nonito Donaire, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but that's how I'm pronouncing it. He fought Wilfredo Vasquez Jr. And the Donaire had already won titles at the flyweight and bantamweight, plus a title at junior bantamweight. Now he won yet another piece of hardware. He's called the Filipino Flash, and despite a damaged hand, and he didn't know he had a damaged hand until he took his glove off, his left hand, and it was soaked with blood, that he won a split decision against Wilfredo Vasquez Jr. Claim the vacant title in the junior featherweight title, and he claimed that title Saturday night. So these two sets of guys, fought last night, had a victory. You know, they celebrated last night. They're still celebrating leading today because of their accomplishments, especially the victors are celebrating. And like I said, this was also at the Alamo Dome and was co-featured bout, like with the first fight I told you about. And Donaire, the victor, said, I quote, "Vasquez was tougher than I expected. He had fought with a broken hand. I couldn't find my rhythm, and I hurt my hand somewhere between the second and fourth rounds. I can only move it a little bit." Now, he's fighting this fight, and it went the distance. It went the distance, and it was a split decision on a broken hand that he may have broken in the second or fourth round, somewhere between there. Now, You've heard of fighters doing that, and some of them quite naturally don't win. The real champions fight through the pain, fight through, have a mental block or whatever, and come out victorious, like Nonita Donaire. Now, he made this was his debut at 122-pound weight class, and fighting Vasquez, he looked frustrated. It looked frustrated at times, but it took Vasquez, and certainly did enough to win despite a disagreement among the judges. Now, the judges, I'm giving you the voting on this. Two judges had it 117-10 for Donaire, while another judge had it 115-112 for Vasquez. Now, that's and the son of a former ESPN also had it for Donaire. So that was a split decision. Quite naturally, 117-110 is a lot different than 115-112. So that's all I can say to you. Anybody have the comments about that? I just wanted to bring those two things out there because I talked about Angelo Dundee. I wanted to talk about those two fights because they were two supposedly marquee fights, two fights that have some guys, quite naturally, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., the son of Julio Cesar Chavez, and Wilfredo Marquez Jr. was the son of former three-division titleist Wilfredo Vasquez Sr. So, like father, like son, these guys are boxing just like the old man's and trying to make a name for themselves. Anyway, let's move on to another subject that I want to get to. This has to pertain to the NFL. This has to pertain to the Hall of Fame. If, for those that don't know, the NFL Hall of Fame had a ceremony yesterday to announce the 6 Hall enshrinees. Let me play this clip that I have about the enshrinees, and then we'll talk about it because I have some opinions on a few guys that did not get into the Hall of Fame that I feel or I felt should have been inducted into the Hall of Fame. One that it's been waiting for a long time, and the other two, other three, that a lot shorter time, but I felt they were warranted also. So let's listen to this clip. It's about 3 minutes long, give or take, and then we'll go from there.
And I am pleased to announce that the class of 2012 members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame are as follows: Jack Butler, Dermoni Dawson, Chris Dolman, Cortez Kennedy, Curtis Martin, and Willie Rolfe. 6 new individuals will be enshrined in camp.
We are in Indianapolis for Super Bowl 46, and just outside the room in which the 2012 Hall of Fame class was announced, I'm here with Steve Dorshak from the Canton Repository. Steve, first up, just what do you make of this class as a whole?
Well, what I make of it is they're going to have to revise the voting procedure because there's no way none of the three wide receivers who was eligible should not have got in. I would have voted for at least 2, and I would submit that all 3 were at least equal in strength of their candidacy to Curtis Martin.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Carter, Andre Reed, Tim Brown, none of them getting in. We'll have to wait another year to see if they get in. Bill Parcells gets left out. He makes the final group but then doesn't get selected. Are you surprised at all?
No. Ironically, if Parcells would have announced emphatically in the early 2000s that he was going to retire, the disposition of the New York media at that time and the media at large was to get Bill in. He came back and coached. There was a little tarnish on his image after he did come back and didn't do that well in Dallas and as an executive in Miami, and that cost him.
Who of the class that did get in, who were you most surprised got in?
Well, let's look at the list real quick. You couldn't have been surprised, really, with anybody who got in this class because it was so even. Maybe Cortez Kennedy, because he was such a mild-mannered individual. But that brings us to another point. Mild-mannered individual, guys of high character. This is a lesson for anybody up for the Hall of Fame. If you're a nice guy and a decent human being, and all the guys on this list are, you have a much better chance of getting into the Hall of Fame.
Who of the guys that didn't make it, besides we talked Parcells, we talked those wide receivers, is there anyone that either made the final group or didn't even get that far? Just what were you most surprised by?
Well, let's look at that list again. The receivers. Number one on my list would have been probably Tim Brown, because as we mentioned the other day, he had more yards by himself than Lynn Swann and John Stallworth, Pittsburgh Steelers teammates, had combined. So that was just still, I'm floored by that none of those receivers got in.
So six new members going in this year, an interesting class to say the least. No Bill Parcells, none of those three wide receivers. We'll have to wait till next year. That's all from the Hall of Fame announcements.
Now, like you're saying now, you got one skill player, Curtis Martin going in, a running back. All these other guys are linemen, and I'm amazed. I am absolutely amazed that, for 2012, this is I wouldn't say a strange class, but it's a class that has, in my opinion, some question marks. Now, I've been saying this for the last few years since we've been doing various shows on the FSP label, FSP crew, FSP the mother show, and recently my year will be in May of the master plan. I can't understand why Chris Carter, one of the all-time great wide receivers, one of the most consistent wide receivers, one of the most prolific, all he does is catch touchdowns, if not going into the Hall of Fame. Once again, I don't understand what the big stigma about not putting Chris Carter in it. Last year was because there was such an array of wide receivers, they didn't have enough room for him. Well, this year, it's all about the linemen. Four linemen are inducted along with a running back. Now, I don't understand what the excuse is this year, why these four linemen had to get in and not one of the wide receivers, meaning Chris Carter, Andre Reed, or Tim Brown. And I can understand to a certain point Bill Parcells. He may have to wait next year or the year before, the year after that to get in. But these wide receivers, any one of them are well-deserving of getting into the Hall of Fame, and for some reason they're left out again. Chris Carter should be in the Hall of Fame. Chris Dolman, the lineman, gets in before Chris Carter. I don't understand it. If someone can enlighten me in the chat room or call me on my line 347-637-3220 and let me know why Chris Carter of all, and I've seen Chris Carter, his good pet, good Chris Carter and bad Chris Carter when he played for the Eagles. He was a very, very good wide receiver. Yes, he had personal issues, but he straightened himself out. He moved on to the Vikings, and he was as prolific, if not even better, when he was with the Vikings. And he doesn't have the opportunity to get into the Hall of Fame. Tim Brown, who in that clip said he had more yards than John Stallworth and Lynn Swann together, and he doesn't get into the Hall of Fame? What, are you kidding me? Come on. Come on. Plus the fact is Tim Brown was a prolific kick returner, a punt returner. You got to be kidding me. Come on. Andre Reed of the four in a row appearances of the Buffalo Bills, his quarterback is in the Hall of Fame. His running back is in the Hall of Fame. I'm talking about Jim Kelly is in the Hall of Fame. And the running back is in the Hall of Fame. And I can't believe it escapes me for now, but his running back is in the Hall of Fame. And that's the dynamic trio, just like the dynamic trio of the Dallas Cowboys. You got Troy Aikman, Michael Irvin, and Emmitt Smith. They're all in the Hall of Fame. What's the problem with Andre Reed not being there? Andre Reed was a prolific wide receiver that would had no problem outside or inside. He would go inside with no problem and take the outside routes with no problem. He was an all-around wide receiver, and he's not in the Hall of Fame. Come on, people. Come on, Hall of Fame committee. Get it together. Get it together. Get these guys in the Hall of Fame. You got four linemen and a running back. Come on. What's wrong with a wide receiver? No wide receiver this year? You got to be kidding me. You got definitely three eligible ones that I'm right off the top of my head that was in that clip that we heard. And you don't even put one of them in there. You put these four linemen ahead of them. That's not right. That's just another excuse that you can't warrant that you did last year when you said you just use one wide receiver. Now it's put up or shut up, and what do? You put four linemen in along with a running back. Enough of that. You got 27 minutes left in this show. And I think we're going to be talking about the Super Bowl. I think, like I said, this is a day of celebration. So the people who have been inducted, or not inducted, but are now going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, they're going to celebrate that they got nominated, not nominated, but they got picked to be in the Hall of Fame. So that's a celebration. Like I said, this is all a celebration of all kinds. And this happens to be a celebration of getting into the Hall of Fame. Now we're going to talk about celebrating the big game, celebrating the pregame, the parties, getting ready for that party, and watching either the New England Patriots or the New York Giants, depending on who your favorite team is, depending on what your rooting interest is. I'll bring this up right now, people. I do not like either of these two teams. I am not a fan of either of these two teams. My team happens to be the New York Jets. Yeah, I know. As soon as I say that, you're going to say, oh, the New York Jets, bunch of big mouths. You're right. I'm not going to deny it. You're right. I talk a lot of junk just like Rex and the company do. I'm not going to deny that. But that doesn't take away from the fact that I do. Well, you can understand why I really don't like the New England Patriots, because they happen to be in the same division as I am. Two very bitter rivals right now. And because we share the same stadium, and I'll say it again, like I said it last year, we're treated like redheaded stepchildren. I don't think we get enough respect as we should, but that's a horse of a different color and a different story. But we'll celebrate the fact is that these two teams are in the Super Bowl, and we'll talk about the Super Bowl, and we'll talk about these two quarterbacks and these two teams, and maybe I'll go through an assessment of how I see these two teams competing against each other, who has the edge. Let's see now. For those who don't know, for those who are living in a bubble for the last two weeks or for the whole football season, and hope you're not that closed-minded that you don't know what's going on, especially the Super Bowl, the New York Giants and the New England Patriots are renewing their rivalry, and I think it's going to be another rivalry within the NFL because they faced each other in 2007. And the Patriots won in the regular season, and the undefeated Patriots were beaten by the New York Giants in the Super Bowl to lose their undefeated status and become 18-1, and that one became the Giants' victory in the Super Bowl, and Eli being the MVP of that Super Bowl. This year, they renewed their rivalry again. And they played each other in a regular season, and the Patriots lost. Just a word of note, and I've said this more than once, the Patriots played only two winning teams all season in the regular season. The Patriots did not beat a team with a winning record in the regular season and only beat one team with a winning record, and that was the Baltimore Ravens, and they barely won that. So just understand that the Patriots did not win a single game in the regular season against a winning team. The two teams they played that had a winning record was the Pittsburgh Steelers, which they lost to, and the New York Giants, who they lost to. They played an 8-8 Denver Broncos team in the playoffs, and they played a 13-3 team in the playoffs, which is the Baltimore Ravens. And due to the mistakes of the Baltimore Ravens, and not more or less the efforts of the New England Patriots, the Patriots are into the Super Bowl, and the Baltimore Ravens are home. Am I bitter? Yes, I'm bitter about that because I felt the Baltimore Ravens at the time were the better team. But what can I tell you? They didn't do what they had to do. So what happens? New England Patriots get fortunate enough to get into the Super Bowl against the New York Giants. The New York Giants, on the other hand, played a couple teams that had a winning record. Quite naturally, they were on a big run. They on a five-game winning streak. They beat the Dallas Cowboys, the New York Jets. They beat the Atlanta Falcons. They beat the Green Bay Packers. And they beat the San Francisco 49ers. Three good teams. But understand this, and I'm saying this again, and I'll say it again and again. Both these teams, the New York Giants and Eli in particular, this is the first game they're playing in a dome in quite some time. And I'm not too sure about the record of Eli in the dome. But let the record speak for itself. Tom Brady and Eli Manning's record in the Indianapolis Superdome. Let's talk about this. That's right, people. Two men enter, one man's going to come victorious. Who's it going to be? Eli Manning and the New York Giants or Tom Brady and the New England Patriots? While both quarterbacks will not be playing the Colts, Eli Manning and Tom Brady's record in Indianapolis may help give an indicator of how they might perform there. While neither Tom Brady or Eli Manning will be playing the Colts in Indianapolis for the Super Bowl, I'm saying, well, why don't we take a look at their record in Indy to possibly gauge how they're going to perform there. Excuse me. Despite his long career and the fact that the Colts and Patriots seem to play every year, Brady has actually only quarterbacked the Patriots in Indianapolis four times during the regular season and one time during the playoffs. The rest of the meetings, believe it or not, came at Foxborough. And Brady's first game in Indianapolis actually came in his first game as a starter. While he played the week before against the Jets when Bledsoe went down, his first game actually started on October 21st in 2001. And in that game, the Patriots dominated from the start. And the final score, the Patriots won the game by a score of 38-17. Now it's in 2001. In November 2003, the Patriots were the defending Super Bowl champions at the time. And when the final score was out, the Patriots were again victorious by the closer score, 38-34. So that's two. He's 2-0 in Indianapolis right now. His next game in Indy came almost 3.5 years later, and that was in 2007. So it's been a while. You know, a lot of games they played, but some of these games were in Foxborough. I'm specifically talking about Brady playing in Indianapolis. We'll go there, and then we'll go to Eli. This was Brady's only appearance in the postseason in Indianapolis. So the Patriots began fast and furious. They went up in this game. I remember this game, 21-3. And before the Colts came back, this game eventually saw the Colts come out on top when Brady threw a fourth quarter interception. I remember that. I forget the wide receiver, but I do remember that. The final score, again, like the previous score the last time they were in Indianapolis, but Colts won this one, 38-34. And then the next matchup came on November 4th, so this is the following season. This is in a regular season game. This was one of the closest games of them all, and saw the Patriots lose again by a score of 35-34. So Brady's record in Indianapolis is 3-2. Let's go to Eli. Eli's only played in Indianapolis one time, and that was back in September of 2010. And Eli and the Giants got killed in that game. 38-14. So what I'm saying is this. Neither Tom Brady or Eli Manning have won at Lucas Field. When the other appearances were in the old stadium. The one time that Brady lost in Indianapolis was in the new stadium. So neither one of these two quarterbacks have won in Lucas Oil Stadium. So this should be pretty interesting. And I've been trying to find out. I can't for the life of me find out this statistic, but I've noticed in other games, especially games that were in the dome and Eli was the quarterback, Eli, and I've said this on a couple other programs this past week, I don't think Eli plays that well in domes. I really don't believe he plays that well in domes. So just keep that in mind you heard it here, if you heard it here, you didn't hear it first, but you may have, if you heard it from someone else, fine. But I really don't think Eli plays that well in domes. I really don't. We'll see what happens. The one time he played in here, he lost. He got killed against a real good offense, and the Giants are going against a real good offense. But they've beat the Patriots the last 2 out of 3 games. So, and they've got a two-game winning streak in the Super Bowl and then this past regular season against them. So we'll see what happens. Let's go and analyze this game piece by piece, okay? We got about 13 minutes left in the game. Excuse me, left in the show. Like I said, this is a show of celebrating victories, celebrating past victories, celebrating past lives, and celebrating the Super Bowl day leading up to the game, celebrating the game, and celebrating after game. So let's talk about these two combatants and what to see in this game. The Patriots rushing. They have Tom Brady at quarterback, one of the best passing games in the NFL. But the Patriots have run the ball at least 30 times in both of their playoffs games, and they've run it with success. Ben Jarvis Green Ellis topped 1,000 yards rushing in 2010 and has 24 touchdowns the past two seasons. Everyone knows, if you know about the Patriots, he's the number one back. But tight end Aaron Hernandez also gets work in the backfield. He's had 8 carries and 70 yards in the playoffs so far. So the Giants can't ignore the run when Green Ellis leaves the field. New York has been a mixed bag against the run all season. The Giants have given up 361 yards on the ground in the postseason, but they haven't allowed a rushing touchdown. Now, I say the edge to the Patriots on that one. Patriots passing. Brady is a 2-time Super Bowl MVP who became the third quarterback to win 4 championships who can become the third quarterback to win 4 championships with a victory today. New England doesn't have a true deep threat to its passing game, but a slot receiver, Wes Welker, bottoms chews up most defenses' backs, and the Patriots have 2 of the best tight ends in the game. Watch out for Ocho Cinco. He's activated. Tyquan Underwood was deactivated for a defensive end, took his spot. So watch out for Ocho Cinco. I think there's going to be some surprises for the Giants secondary. And the Patriots, Ron Gronkowski, their biggest matchup problem, and the NFL leader in touchdowns, is nursing a high ankle sprain, and quite naturally, you know he's not 100%. The Giants beat, battered, and bruised Tom Brady in their first Super Bowl meeting, thanks to a relentless pass rush, and I think they'll do the same thing. They're going to have a relentless pass rush. The first time they met, Brady didn't face all the pass rushers because they weren't all healthy. They're all healthy now. He's going to get the full complement of the menu right now of pass rushers from the Giants. They need to do that again. And like I said, Jason Pierre-Paul is a monster off the edge, and outside linebacker Michael Boley is key to covering Gronkowski and Hernandez. Good luck in that. Edge Patriots. Giants rushing. No team was worse running the ball this season than the Giants. They averaged 89.2 yards a game and a miserable 3.5 a carry, and had the fewest rushes of 20 or more yards of any team in the NFL. Well, that could be attributed to Ma Bradshaw being hurt all the time, because Brandon Jacobs is not a speed burner, quite naturally. He's a power and bruiser, so he's not going to bust a lot of 20-yard or more rushing. So Ma Bradshaw is the type of back to do that, and he's been hurt a lot, and he's still hurt nursing a foot injury, so we'll see what happens with that. But that's still probably going to hold true in this game. Ahmad Bradshaw has been playing on a fractured foot, like I said, since October, but he remains the New York's most consistently effective back, which is true. The Giants do a good job running the ball near the goal line. They were sixth in the league with 17 rushing touchdowns. But everyone knows Hakeem Nicks, Mario Manningham, and quite naturally Victor Cruz, that this team is a passing team. Everyone knows that. Jerod Mayo doesn't get enough credit as one of the best linebackers for New England, and the defensive Vince Wilfork is coming off a monster AFC championship game, and he's been coming on. He's been playing lights out. So the edge for the rushing, Giants rushing, would be the Patriots, edge to the Patriots. Now, let's get to the Giants passing side of this. Giants, what New York lacks on the ground, it more than makes up for the air. Eli, everyone knows Eli's been prolific passing the ball this year. He almost passed for 5,000 yards, and he had the best record of any quarterback in the league, setting records of performing in the fourth quarter. So Eli is short for elite quarterback. Let me put it that way. He's having the best season of his career and has put himself in the conversation, like I said, when it comes to the games. Eli, elite quarterbacks. His accuracy has improved in recent years, and he's tough enough to take a hit. Yeah, he's been bruised and battered. He was sacked six times. That's not counting the times he was hit. He was sacked six times in the San Francisco game, and they still prevailed in that game. The Giants have two very good receivers in Hakeem Nicks and Victor Cruz. And Nicks destroyed the Packers in the second round of the playoffs, and Cruz has emerged from nowhere to become Manning's top target, just like Steve Smith was one of Eli Manning's go-to guys in the slot for the most part. Victor Cruz has taken his spot and done it very well and even exceeded what Steve Smith used to do. And it's a big problem matchup for the New England Patriots out of the slot. Even though New England has done a better job of getting pressure up front than in the past, thanks to the addition of Mark Anderson, who had 10 sacks, the Patriots have serious concerns in the back end. And they've gotten burned left and right in the back end. Even receiver Julia Edelman sometimes doubles as a slot cornerback. And the Giants have said, for good reason, they'll try to expose him when he's on the field. Excuse me, I got to wet my whistle here. Thank you. So, quite naturally, the Patriots are one of the worst in the league in pass coverage, edge Giants. Let's go to the special teams. The Giants wouldn't be here if not for timely plays by the special teams in an NFL championship win over the 49ers. Quite naturally, Devin Thomas recovered two fumble punts that game, and everyone knows Lawrence Times kicked the game-winning field goal in overtime to beat the 49ers to beat where they are right now. The Patriots advanced to the Super Bowl thanks to their own fortuitous, and I said it before, fortuitous special teams play. The Ravens botched the potential game-tying 32-yard field goal, so this phase of the game could be crucial. While neither team is overly explosive in the return game, Edelman had a 72-yard punt return touchdown this season. Zoltan Mesko gives New England a slight edge in the punting game, while Tynes Metal isn't an issue for New York. I give a slight edge to the Patriots in this. Now, overall, the Giants and Patriots last 4 years ago gave us a real thrill, and it came down to the end in the last Super Bowl in 2007. And I don't see any reason why it's going to be any different here. You got two star quarterbacks, and it's more than likely it could come down to the defense. Can New York dominate dominant pass rush get enough pressure on Tom Brady to negate the matchup problems the Patriots caused with their two tight ends? And then on the other end, how does the New England secondary deal with Victor Cruz? Brady had a subpar performance against the Baltimore Ravens in the last game and the AFC Championship game. They lost to the Giants in the Super Bowl in 2007. They lost to the Giants in his past regular season. I'm thinking he wants to get revenge for his only Super Bowl loss and wants to get a ring today. Now, I had said on the FSP Cruz show that I thought this was going to be a close game. I was up in the air about which way I wanted to go because these two teams, Giants, Patriots, I'm not too fond of these two teams at all. I said on the FSP Cruz show that I leaned toward the Giants. I said on the FSP show that I reversed my thought and I went with the Patriots. I'm sticking with my thoughts. Unfortunately, I really don't like picking this team. I do not like anything about this team. It puts a bad taste in my mouth talking about this team. But I'm obligated to talk about the Super Bowl. Everyone, this is Super Bowl Sunday. This is the last day, the crowning moment for the NFL for the season. This is really the last game of the season. You got to celebrate it. You got to have a good time about it. Because, like I said, this is the last real game of the NFL season. And hopefully it's going to be a tight game, an exciting game. I'm looking more forward to the, believe it or not, the halftime show. Because Madonna's going to be there. I thought maybe Nicki Minaj may be there. And CeeLo. So if all three of those artists are there, I'm looking forward to an enjoyable halftime show. And an exciting Super Bowl. My prediction is this. I think the Patriots will win the game 31-28, because I don't think either one of these teams is really going to be able to stop each other for any length of time. I got like a minute and a half left in the show. Got about a minute left in the show. So tune in next week. First of all, tune in on Tuesday for Compassion Dakani with Kim Funk. Tune in, that was just 4 to 4:30. Tune in on Thursday, which is the FSP Cruz show, 8 to 9 with myself as the host, Black the Bookie, and Jeff the Joker, two co-hosts. Tune in on Saturday with Vic Gardner, the FSP show, the home show, which starts at 1 o'clock. Vic Gardner, like I said, is the host. I'm the co-host. And also, tune in on Sunday, again, the Master Plan, 10 o'clock in the morning till 11, 1 hour. We'll recap what we talked about today and talk about what's going to take place in the future. It's been a pleasure. We're going to end it with a nice song to celebrate from. Enjoy the Super Bowl. Enjoy the game. We're out.
I was thinking about this. Picture on the news, yeah, they see about this. Even in the paper, they gon' read about this. Cause all of my life, training day and night, I'm preparing to fight for everyone. Never leave crowds going insane. Yeah, they screaming our name while we spraying champagne. Nothing nobody can say. Cause today is the day, is the day that I am always. Everybody count it out. Everybody up, now we back down. All our pain and struggles for this moment right now. All from different places, but we came with each other. We came together as a team, but we leaving as brothers. Standing next to one another while we hold up our colors.
I'm gonna look into the camera, tell my mama I love her, love.
Today is the day, is the day that I have always dreamed of. Forever, when you call me, you call me the champ.